You are all league champions in my eyes. On this episode of Baseball Barbercast, we will preview the ALCS, the NLCS, and I guess review the worst stinker of the postseason so far, Dodgers taking game one against the Mets. All of that and not a lot more on this episode of Baseball Barbercast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows the last time the Dodgers allowed a run is when Sandy Koufax wouldn't pitch on Shmeniat Sarit. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And with Yom Kippur over, the only thing we're hungry for is runs.
Yeah, I have forgotten what it looks like for a Dodger pitcher to allow a run, except that I haven't, because the last time it happened, it was really cool. It was when Fernando Tatis Jr. took Walker Buehler to the moon. But that was a long time ago. As we are recording this late on Sunday evening, just moments after the Dodgers completed their third consecutive shutout, tying a postseason record that I happen to just have referenced on the last episode, the Orioles in the 1966 World Series against the Dodgers. None of these same players were still around, so it's not like this is, you know, some sort of karmic retribution. But
I think Kike was there.
Kike, yeah, that's true. He's
primordial.
Been around for a while. Chris Taylor, for sure, was really struggling during that series. But yeah, I mean, this is we've seen history here as the Dodgers take game one of the NLCS over the Mets in historic fashion. They have not allowed a run now in 33 consecutive innings, and they will be carrying that streak into game two with a pitcher to be determined. So that makes this all the more interesting. But yes, on this episode, we are going to, I guess, talk a little bit about this clunker of a game one and preview the ALCS, which begins on Monday night in New York. You will be there. I will be there for games 3, 4, and 5 because the Cleveland Guardians are still playing baseball. We'll get to all that and more later on in the show. But let's stick in the NL, Jake. Let's stick with the Dodgers here. Again, we plan to record this as soon as this game ends. Well, maybe we'd get some crazy, like, no, this game was over pretty early, so we don't have to spend too much time on this one, but also we plan to preview this series, so I guess we'll kind of do that with the knowledge that the Dodgers just, you know, pantsed the Mets in game one.
I gotta cross out my Mets in 4 prediction. Well, that's unfortunate. That's anybody who predicts a sweep in a series is awesome, just so you know. Like, I think that's real courage, is just
especially
really...
once we get to, you know, best of 7.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so how did we get here? We have not talked since Dodgers-Padres game 5, which was also pretty simple. Yamamoto was dominant. Darvish was very good, and dominant is better than very good. And the Padres offense went nap time on everybody in LA 1. And it was both anticlimactic and perfect at the same time, these two teams going back and forth all series. And then, you know, when the noise got loud, the Padres offense just didn't do jack. Speaking of Jack, he pitched tonight. Tonight, game one was Jack Flaherty on the mound for the Dodgers against Kodai Senga for the Mets. Now, Kodai Senga literally threw one start in the regular season. He has now made 2 in October. Neither of them were particularly long. His first start was good in 2 innings. Tonight was not exactly the case. He was all over the place from the jump. Now, the plan was only to get 2 or 3 innings out of him and kick it over to David Peterson for the middle frames. But Senga was just abysmal, was walking the farm. 2 outs, bases loaded in the first. Single up the middle, I believe, to Max Muncy. And that was it. Dodgers up 2-0, and then they just never look back. Senga's out of there in the second inning. Reed Garrett bridges to David Peterson. David Peterson doesn't look good either. Otani hits a freaking laser beam. Like, he has an RBI single earlier or whatever, but he deletes a baseball off the wall, which apparently was just a single, not a double.
Yeah, I don't really know why it was ruled that. I guess because it was hit so hard that Marte and Wright did try to pick it up pretty quickly, but then he kind of fumbled it. But yeah, I mean, this was just Senga. Not only was the command bad, the stuff was bad, the velo was down, all of it was just very unpleasant. This one was over pretty quickly. And you knew once they fell down with the way Flaherty was looking, I mean, there was just wasn't much suspense in this one.
Really strong three pitch mix tonight from Flaherty, fastball, knuckle, the knuckle curve, and the slider. All were really good. He had 11 whiffs, and the slider to me, he was the pitch he did a really good job keeping on the outer half to a lot of those righties, making sure that the Mets stayed off balance. And this is like why you trade for Jack Flaherty, right? So that he can deliver a performance like this. He was pretty shaky in his first October start, seemed to be much more under control in this one, which maybe is portends well for our friend Carlos. But Jack was, he was on it. And there's not a whole lot more to say about this game. Jesse Winker had a total toot bland for the ages where he got caught in between first and second. The Mets used all of their B relievers late in the game. Danny Young, Jose Buto, and that's it. That's I have nothing else to say.
No, I mean, three hits.
Jeff McNeil played.
Jeff McNeil played. Again, this is a totally bizarre situation just because he played in the Arizona Fall League yesterday or the day before. I don't know if he got one game in or two. Of course, he's been coming back from injury. And the real reason they put him on there is because the Dodgers only have one left-handed pitcher in this series on this roster because Alex Vesia got hurt. And now as we transition to kind of previewing the rest of the series, you know, we can kind of go a little bit bigger picture, even though, of course, the Dodgers are now already off to a very comfortable one-game lead in this one. But yeah, I mean, McNeil was added. It seemed like, okay, well, are you really just going to slot him right in there against Flaherty after having barely played? And no, because Iglesias has been so good. But clearly they think that McNeil can help them, so they add him instead of Ottavino. But yeah, so that's again, game one. It's already over. Like, here we go. Dodgers are up 1-0. But as we look forward to the rest of the series, what are some of the other things that intrigue you about this one?
Plunk, you know, I, in order to better sound out the narrative machine, I watched Peaky Blinders season 4 this week, really? In which Tommy Shelby is just putting down strikes left and right. And the amount of machine sounds in that season really make me feel prepared.
I'm glad that we're not going to see Glass now, so you can at least watch Tommy Shelby do his thing.
That is a very good point. Narrative Machine, 2015 NLDS. Mm.
Did anything cool happen in that one? I don't remember.
I believe Yoenis Cespedes hit a home run off Alex Wood to the moon. And Chase Utley, I think, murdered Ruben Tejada.
It was all on television, yes. All of that happened. It wasn't even like the Mets were, they were chilling. Like, there's no, again, it's very different than what we saw in this one where, you know, the Dodgers were making it look easy. But again, who is left from that? Zero Mets, obviously.
Zero Mets are left from that. And Kershaw, Austin Barnes, Kike, and Chris Taylor, I believe. And Jack Flaherty, who was there as a fan.
Chris Taylor was on the team yet, right?
No, he was there.
He was in 2015. Okay, I didn't remember that. No, that's wrong. He was not there in 2015
because
he was still on the Mariners. I was like, that's a little bit before 2017 is when he really started balling out. Anyway, yeah, it's not many, of course, that are holding over from that. And since Kershaw's not even going to be a part of this, you know, how many overlap or Barnes, I guess, right? Yeah.
But it's another really narrative. Two of the three biggest cities in America: New York on the East Coast, LA on the West Coast.
That is a thing when we might have to do it all over again in the World
and
Series.
Then the biggest city in America obviously is Oberlin, Ohio, where you're currently coming from. So those are the narratives that I'm thinking about. There's really not a whole lot of overlap in terms of personnel. JD Martinez, who was on the Dodgers last year, he's probably coming in with all the hot secrets, you know, whispering in the Mets' ears like, "Hey, Max Muncy doesn't like mushrooms," or you know, the
might
little
come in
nuggets.
Handy. Yeah, like I don't want to pretend like that doesn't matter. Maybe it does.
It does for you as someone who hates mushrooms. Better offense, not really that close. Not just saying this because what we saw tonight, Jordan can attest. I wrote this down on the document hours ago. To me, the Dodgers lineup, it has now reached a level of almost underrated. Yes, Shohei Ohtani is so good. We know that. Mookie, Freddie. Beyond them, there's a lot of good hitters. Like, if the Dodgers were rolling out a lineup that did not feature the three MVPs at the top, it's probably still like a top half lineup in baseball. And I think we got some good evidence of that tonight with the bottom of the lineup manufacturing a few of those runs.
Well, and I just think Muncy and Teoscar just, and I know Muncy was hurt for a lot of the season, but with Teoscar having the best season, you know, of his career, really, and with what Muncy has been able to give them when he's healthy, and Will Smith is still one of the best hitting catchers in baseball, and he's barely in there. And if you're getting contributions from Kike, then it's just, again, we've talked all season, like hitting in the postseason, as we have seen this postseason, hitting is very difficult. So we've seen all season, right? Offense and generally harder than ever. But, you know, the league OPS in this postseason is a whole lot lower than it was in the regular season, as we are seeing pitching staffs like the Dodgers pile up these scoreless innings. And this Dodgers team just keeps on cooking, and they just have so many ways to score. And that's still with, you know, Ohtani, who was striking out a bunch at the end of that series against the Padres. It's with Freddie, who is hobbling around. It's with Mookie, who was cool for the first couple games. But they just have so many outs. And that's the wrong way to play it, because it's the opposite of that. But they have so many guys, so many just kind of escape hatches where it's just like, oh, he's not going well. That's fine. We have this guy. Like, it's just too many good hitters for all of them to go cold at once, which even compared to last year, the last couple of years when they have gone cold, I think that's why they're in such a good position.
Jordan, top five Dodgers by WRC plus over the last 3 months of the season. Okay. Number one is Ohtani. Number two, Teoscar. Number four, Freddie. Number five, Mookie. Who is sandwiched in between those guys? You think about it. You think, you rub your chin. It's Gavin Lux, a man who we have barely talked about. Gavin Lux has been a legitimately phenomenal hitter now for 3 months. Okay. Now, Gavin Lux, top prospect, hurt his ACL in spring training 2 years ago, missed all last year, and was just terrible for the first 2 months of this year. But here's the thing. Ronald Acuna, remember how much time it took him to come back after he hurt his leg in a similar fashion? Lux seems to be finally kind of figuring out some things at the plate. And if he's going to be hitting seventh or eighth in this lineup and has a 137 WRC plus over the last 3 months, like, that's a lot of depth that the Mets, frankly, don't have right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And we should mention Lux did leave the game tonight with some sort of hip injury. Now, it doesn't seem like he would be starting against Manaea in game two anyway. And it doesn't seem like this was like a serious issue, but we can just mention that. But yeah, and then adding Edman, who, especially when he's batting right-handed, is a legitimately impactful hitter and obviously showed ways he can impact the game otherwise. So it really is a 1-9 situation, which you just cannot say about basically any other lineup in the league. And that was true before we got down to the final four teams, but now it is definitely true when you compare to them to some of these other teams left.
And it is small sample size theater, but the bottom of the Mets lineup has not been particularly great in October.
Yeah.
Jose Iglesias, as adorable as we all find him, and enjoyable as OMG is, by the way, remix featuring Pitbull now out. Consume that. Listen, if you haven't already.
Listen, Jose Iglesias can go 0-40 the rest of the way. He is one of the biggest winners of 2024, and it's correct, not even close.
As CJ Abrams would say, he's playing with house money. Yeah, Iglesias has been not very good. Neither has Tyrone Taylor, Bader, Francisco Alvarez coming into this game. No.
Hey, yeah, I mean, Alvarez is, it's again, he's, What an interesting just person to just, as far as just importance to the Mets future and present. And by the way, let's give Francisco Alvarez credit. What did he do tonight? He caught Shohei Ohtani stealing, which has not happened since the end of July. 36 consecutive steals for Ohtani until Francisco Alvarez said, not so fast, buddy. Listen, you could score as many runs as you want in this game, but you are not stealing a base on me. So credit for Alvarez making fun of that. But the point is offensively, he has not been as impactful as I think they would have hoped he would be at this point in the season.
I make this point to say that I think the top of the Mets lineup versus the top of the Dodgers lineup, like, at face, that seems like a big gap, right? Just because the Dodgers have three MVPs, basically. But I think the bigger gap is at the bottom.
Yeah.
I think the lack of depth for the Mets is actually the bigger problem. Once you get past that top five, it gets a little bit thin. However, even though tonight Jack Flaherty was dominant against, I wrote this down, a COVID Sengerson, which is Kodai, Senga, and David Peterson, I would still take the Mets rotation the rest of the way. And that is because in game two, they will throw Sean Manaea up there against Tom Brady's dad, aka TBD, which might be Walker Buehler or it might be Jonathan Holstaff. Severino of Luis fame, he will throw game three at home, probably, against either Walker Buehler or Jonathan Holstaff. And then game four.
Or
looks,
actually Tom Brady's dad.
Tom Brady's dad.
We can rule him out. They're probably one more pitching injury away. Yeah.
This is a dumb bit that Jordan and I have had for years where we see TBD, we just say it's Tom Brady's dad. We have news here via producer Andrew Hartz. Carlos Mendoza isn't committing right now to going back to Kodai Senga for game five. We've got to wait and see how he responds, the manager said. I think it's going to come down to how he's going to bounce back. That's from Anthony Tacoma at MLB.com. Yeah, I wouldn't commit to Kodai Senga either if I was Carlos Mendoza. So 10 points for Gryffindor.
Yeah, I'll just say this. I wouldn't be so concerned about game five right now if I was the Mets. I'll just put it. I'm not saying that they're not going to get there. I'm just saying that, like, that's not my first thought after this game. It's, can you win the game tomorrow?
The three hits, please?
Yes, right. Exactly. Like, that's not what I mean. They're not going to get there. It's just like, I'm not thinking about game five. So I understand why the question's being asked, but either way, you know, do they just go with Peterson, McGill? Like, there are other things they could do, but obviously they're going to have to bounce back on Monday.
You know, a big reason why they still have a chance in this series, obviously, is just one game, is that their best pitcher is throwing tomorrow. Sean Manaea, who has been unbelievable for them down the stretch and more or less single-handedly beat the Phillies in game three. He was just dominant, going seven innings. He's going tomorrow against either Walker Buehler or a whole host of people.
Yeah, but again, Manaea is just such an important matchup, really, for here. And obviously, you would have hoped maybe if you get Peterson in the game sooner, you get a lefty. But in theory, left-handers should be a better matchup against the Dodgers, against Ohtani. Again, we saw Ohtani have some issues, you know, with the likes of Tanner Scott. I know that's a high-leverage guy late, but if you can't get some of the matchups here against Ohtani, against Freddie, against Muncy, listen, you're still dealing with guys that destroy lefties like Teoscar, like Muncy, obviously Mookie. So there's no easy way to do it. But Manaea, just for how good he's been, I mean, this is going to be a very different assignment with respect to the Phillies. You know, doing it at Dodger Stadium is going to be a little bit different than doing it at home against the Dodgers, the version of the Phillies offense that we were watching.
And I think you just have to take the Mets. I would rather have the Mets pitcher in every game the rest of the series. The only matchup where I genuinely believe they have the advantages of the Flaherty game. And maybe this sounds like shade to Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who was amazing in the clincher.
Yeah.
You can laugh, Jordan.
No, I know. Katana's been unbelievable. I'm not saying it's totally wrong. I'm saying I'm not as certain about it for that fourth game. But I mean, yeah, love Severino and because of Buehler, I mean, I know he sort of gritted through and managed to give them some length, but like, I'm definitely not super confident about him. So yeah, I think that is a reason to feel confident about the Mets. And yeah, Quintana has been amazing.
In, I think this is six starts, he has allowed, that's more than six, excuse me. He's allowed three earned runs since August 20th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll take that over Yoshi Yamamoto.
So he's faced.
I just like, so maybe that's wonky. That.
Padres, White Sox, Reds, Phillies, Nats, Brewers, and then Phillies again. So again, there's some good teams sprinkled in there for sure, and some bad ones. But yeah, he's been really good. I just think, again, I'm gonna say this about any pitcher, is that it's what we just started this conversation with, which is that the Dodgers lineup is ridiculous. So it's not just not saying that he's not good or hasn't had a good run, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Better bullpen, the Dodgers. I mean, they haven't allowed a run since they were the Brooklyn Bridegrooms and they were playing in Flatbush, and my grandmother was walking over there to see games. Like, I think the Mets bullpen is just a little thin for who they have at the back end. I mean, Diaz is Diaz, but it's Diaz, Stanek, McGill, Peterson, if it's the right day, Reed Garrett. Like, it just, Phil Maton has been all right.
Yeah. And then they used they use, I thought Garrett was one of like their higher leverage guys, and he comes in a little bit earlier. So
they, but I no, mean, but they, fine. Today was a little different. They still see him as a high leverage guy. They brought Garrett in today to kind of bridge that gap to give them a chance to stay in the game. It didn't end up working out.
Right.
But there's, the Dodgers are just a better unit right now. Yeah. Also, shouts out, friend of the show, Brent Honeywell, on the roster. Will he pitch in anything resembling leverage?
I mean, here's the thing. On one hand, it's like, okay, he's got to pitch the ninth tonight. On the other hand, it's a planned bullpen game. I mean, if you're going reliever, 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 maybe you roll Brent out there for 7-8-9 at some point. I'd love to see it.
Against the lefties. That's the other thing, right? The Dodgers have one lefty in their bullpen. Mm-hmm. That's Anthony Bonda.
And Brent's a little bit better.
Reverse splits guy because he throws all the screwballs and changeups. So
we
shall see. Season series. Only thing I remember from this season series is when the Dodgers came into Citi Field in May and beat the Mets so bad that Jorge Lopez threw his glove into the crowd. That was
That was the same series. Interesting.
Yes, it was.
So, yeah, I mean, I believe the Dodgers, right, the Dodgers swept them in at the end of May, so all three games. But then in the Mets took the series in Los Angeles, I believe. That was in, I think, July? I don't remember when that was exactly. But, yeah, I mean, that obviously they, on the broadcast tonight, you know, they're going through that was in April. That was actually the beginning of the season. The Mets took 2 of 3 in Los Angeles. That was obviously a very long time ago. But to your point, yes, the Jorge Lopez game, of course, that was the bottom, right? That was the bottom of the season, is when they got swept there. They fell to 22-33 on May 29th, and then they've been pretty amazing since then.
X factor in this series for me is the late inning matchups for Otani. I know those late inning matchups didn't matter in game one because it was 6-0 by the time it got late. That being said, how the Mets try and attack Otani late in games will be fascinating, just because they also really only have one lefty in the bullpen. I know David Peterson is technically a lefty, and they will try and utilize him against Otani in certain ways, but like Peterson's not going to be able to throw tomorrow, you would imagine, after having so much length tonight. And so that leaves Danny Young, who also threw 2 innings tonight, I think. He is going to have to, those two guys are in charge of Otani. Sure. And it'll be interesting to see how they attack Otani in a similar or different way than they attacked Harper, another left-handed hitter who's dangerous late in games. So just something that I would keep an eye on. Jordan, prediction, what do you got?
I mean, I was going to say Dodgers in six before the series, so I guess I'll stick with that. But I don't know. I mean, I've been saying this since kind of the beginning of September, like the Dodgers might be able to outscore everyone. And if they're pitching this well, then it's going to be really hard to beat them. Listen, we could get, and even still now, like I don't blame you at all, but even still now you're looking at the starting pitching or the pitching situation over these next couple of days being like, oh, Dodgers, I'm worried. I mean, I guess I am, but I just,
I don't know if enough worried. Guys throw.
Yeah, no, I know. But like, you're still saying like Dodgers, they don't have the edge there. And I know you're speaking more about the Mets than the Dodgers there, but I don't know. I feel like we've been probably just underselling the kind of the collective strength.
Are you saying
of the Dodgers
pitching
staff?
It is funny, right? Like for all of September, understandably, the vibe was who the heck are the Dodgers going to throw? And here we are and they've thrown, you know, 75,000 consecutive squirrels innings. So it's like, who knows?
Right. That's kind of what I mean. Is it's hard to keep saying I'm worried when now not only are they winning, but they're putting up historic stretches of run prevention. So
that being said, I will take the Mets in four.
All right. That's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a tough one for you to win.
Maybe they can get like a double play.
I love the confidence there.
Forfeit game one.
What was your pick going to be before tonight?
Before tonight, Dodgers in six.
Okay. All right. So you're right. You're right there with me.
But after what I saw, Mets in four.
Mets in four. Okay. Got it. Interesting. All right. I should also just note, we are going to say goodbye to the Padres, which we normally do throughout this postseason. We're going to do it at the end of the show.
So Jordan.
Don't worry. Yeah.
Jordan. No Padres fans are listening to a baseball podcast right now. Respectfully.
Come on. Let's give a look. I want to make sure we give them. So even if they aren't listening, there's other people. We still need to say goodbye to the Padres. That's how this show works. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we will turn our attention to the American League. And boy, oh boy, we got some topics for that. All right. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Let's get American with it. Gardo's, Yanks, best of seven. Who wins? We don't know. Neither do you. But we'll try and dumb it down here for you. How did the Gardo's get here? Well, they took the Lane train. Lane Thomas, with the swing of his life, a grand salami off Tarik Skubal in a back-breaking, enthralling moment that really we will remember for a long time, and surely Tigers fans will too. Gardo's hold on to send the gritty Tigers home. We will say goodbye to them later on. But let's focus on the Guardians. Jordan, you were not at Game 5 because of Yom Kippur. Shouts out to you.
Shouts out to the late time change, which is really an unfortunate bounce for me. But you know what? It's okay. I knew that I would see one of these teams again later this week, and it will indeed be these Guardians. And listen, this game in particular, of course, I was a pretty impressive collective effort here. For as good as Matt Boyd looked for the first two innings, to trust that you could still find a way to get seven more innings out of the bullpen, which has obviously been awesome, but you had those scary moments. But that Lane Thomas swing, as you mentioned, will be remembered for a long time. And Skubal, they went down with him, right? I think almost any other pitcher, certainly left-handed pitcher, would have been pulled before Thomas there. Just because Thomas has crushed lefties, and I don't think anyone was saying, I wasn't even on Twitter really over the weekend, but like, I don't think it was saying Hinch blew it, but like that was a situation where you go down with your Cy Young winner and Thomas got him. And that's just baseball, man. And it's what was so great about that moment too, is it was building up to Jose Ramirez with the bases loaded. That was really the one that we were excited to see. And then, you know, he plunks him and then Thomas that first pitch. So all of which is to say just how they were able to kind of manage, literally manage and navigate through the series, and where the Tigers kind of gave them all they could handle. I think Cleveland proved they were the deeper and better team for sure. It took a lot out of him, but there's reasons to feel pretty good about Cleveland going into this next round.
Can I float a quick take here? The Tigers game five loss, is that the best playoff loss you can have? Because look, losing a playoff series is soul crushing no matter what. Like, there's no good way to do this. Okay. Right. And I'm thinking about that experience compared to like the way the Orioles went out, which was just rolling over and playing dead. But the reason I say this is because, okay, so you go down with your best guy. No one's mad at the process, right? Mm. Tarik Skubal got beat on one pitch, okay? Yep. And then the Tigers came back and chipped away, but didn't make it so close that you believed. And so Tigers fans are like, we didn't give up, but I was not sucked back in. You know, sucked back in. So I think it's about as good of a soul-crushing playoff loss as you can have, well, all things considered.
You're really testing if there's any Tigers fans listening to this, but I would certainly like to know their perspective. I would just say, having covered the first four games of the series, it's still tough to swallow that you were seven outs away from advancing, right? As much as the Lane Thomas Grand Slam hurts, the David Fry one hurts so much more, because you had Brisky, who had been hitless, who had not allowed a hit. You seemingly had the matchup. You were seven outs away. You had that one, combining it with this hurts a lot more, because you were close to advancing, right? If the series is a little bit more back and forth and you hadn't kept the Guardians, you shut the Guardians out two consecutive games, right? We were just talking about this. The Tigers did look like they had it there. That's why. But if we're zooming in on game five, I hear what you're saying. So that's fine. That's fine. But ultimately, again, like Ramirez and Kwan, who's, oh my gosh. I mean, Steve Kwan is on a completely different level right now. 11 hits in this series, which was incredible. We'll talk about the Tigers more later, but let's focus on Cleveland moving on. Because I have more Tigers thoughts. Yeah, I have more Tigers thoughts, but we'll save them for later. So let's get that narrative machine buzzing here. Gardo's Yankees. Did we just see this in the postseason? Yes, we did. And it was a lot more recent than 2015. There are a lot of players left from the last time these two teams met in the postseason. as the 2022 ALDS was a fairly memorable division series, as the Guardians went up 2-1 and the Yankees came storming back, had a situation where, you know, the Guardians had to decide, do we throw Bieber on 3 days rest? No, we'll throw Aaron Civale in Yankee Stadium. He did not get out of the first inning, and the Yankees ended up winning that series. This is also the series where Harrison Bader hit 3 home runs. That was after a very, very wild sequence for him there. Giancarlo and Judge both homered twice, I believe, in that series. There are a lot of position players left from this series, but not as many pitchers. The only pitchers left that appeared in that series that are on these active rosters are Gerrit Cole, Clay Holmes, Clark Schmidt, Emmanuel Clase, and Eli Morgan, who appeared late in that game 5. But otherwise, the Guardians pitching staff certainly looks very different. Now, a lot of that has to do with injuries to Bieber and McKenzie and the like, but there is definitely some, these guards, especially Kwan, right, who was a rookie, like that was their, the taste of a lot of these guys, the taste of the postseason for the first time. And they will definitely be wanting to avenge it this time in a best of 7 instead of a best of 5.
And that series also was in the shadow of earlier in that season when the Guardians were there. And yes, there was like the play where Miles Straw climbed the fence and the fans started yelling bad, heinous things at Stephen Kwan. And it got like really heated. And then there was like a weird walk-off play where someone got hurt and there was trash. And like it was all really spicy. And that series in 2022, our producer, the Yankees fan, can confirm this. The amount of difficulty the Yankees had with the Guardians that year made it pretty obvious that they had no chance against the Astros in the ALCS. And then the Astros just, you know, boat raced them.
Yep.
And it was like, we're taking the very Guardians true, who can't hit the ball out of the infield to 5 games. Like,
yes,
maybe we're not World Series material.
Sure. Yes, that is very, very true. However, I'm skipping ahead here a little bit, but I do think that it is important that this is not the same team. And while you might think like, oh, here comes this grampy Guardians who play small ball relative to the Yankees, sure, that is definitely still true. The Yankees did lead Major League Baseball in home runs. But unlike 2 years ago when the Guardians ranked 29th, last year when the Guardians ranked 30th, Cleveland could hit the ball out of the yard a little bit more this season. They were tied for 12th in home runs this season. And they showed already in this past series that they are capable of hitting the ball over the fence when they need to. And I think in New York in particular, there's reasons to believe they'll be able to do that. But I just wanted to mention that. Otherwise, in terms of other narratives that we have, I mean, the payrolls, you know, discourse is going to be obvious. This expands to the whole, you know, LCS field when you have the Mets, the Dodgers, and Yankees, which are the top three payrolls in the sport, with Cleveland, who I think ranks 24th or 25th. It's kind of lazy. It's kind of easy. But I would say that, like, it's not, I don't think it needs to be made more of what it is, but it is a thing. Like, we shouldn't pretend like it doesn't exist. Like, I do think that there's parts of it that is compelling. And it's not a matter to say it shouldn't necessarily glorifying one more than the other. I think we like when baseball teams spend money on baseball players. So generally we lean towards the teams that are doing that because that's where we would like to see the money go. You can also, we've had these conversations. You could also give immense amounts of credit to program, you know, I always said program, I'm thinking college baseball terms, programs to organizations like Cleveland that are able to win as consistently as they are. And they've shown it once again this season with one of the youngest teams in baseball. So, you know, that'll be beaten into the broadcast, I'm sure. And I know you'll roll your eyes at some point, but it's not something we should completely ignore either.
But look, yeah, I mean, there are three of the teams that are payrolls over $300 million. There are three of them, and all three of them are still in. Okay, yeah. It's the Mets, yeah, the Yankees, and the Dodgers. And I think that actually gives us good insight into what that money does. It really gives you just a lot of leeway to make mistakes.
Yes, it's both. It gets you the best players at the top, and it allows you to just try something and it not work, and you can still be here. Marcus Stroman would be Cleveland's highest paid player.
And
he'll be on the roster.
I think he will
be. You think he's going to get at it? Okay, so yeah, maybe he'll get at it. But whatever. The point is, it's like Cleveland they cannot afford to make these mistakes. And in some ways, that's been true. But, you know, sometimes where they've spent money and we'll see. But the point is they can't take those risks.
Yeah.
And they obviously cannot go out of their way to add the highest end talent in the sport.
the Yankees paid Aaron Hicks nearly $10 million this year.
LeMahieu.
Okay. Well, like, just wait. Yeah, LeMahieu is different. Okay. LeMahieu is different.
Yeah.
Because LeMahieu, they are expecting to be on the team. The Yankees paid Aaron Hicks $10 million this year to be horrible for the Angels for 2 months.
Right.
Aaron Hicks would, let me finish. Yeah. Aaron Hicks would be tied for the third highest paid player on the Guardians with Alex Cobb. Okay. Yes. So like that is what we're talking.
Wasn't on the team for most of the season, right?
Wasn't so really he'd be the third highest paid player behind Jose Ramirez and Shane Bieber. Okay, and that just and the Mets are actually the best example of using the money to make mistakes. If you go and look at how much money they're paying off from all those trades, the Guardians cannot afford to do that. Again, it is both impressive from a front office perspective and unfortunate from an ownership perspective because look, are the Guardians ever going to get above $300 million? No. Are they ever going to get above $200?
Maybe
not,
until the inflation
wheels fall off, but could they be at 150? Probably. Right. And so I think for us, it's our responsibility as people who get paid to talk about this is to acknowledge both sides of that coin. Like the differences here matter, but it's good that the rich teams spend money. That is a good thing.
And it's good when they succeed because you want to have these other teams motivated to do so, right? And the Phillies and Padres were also right there too, right? And there are obviously two other teams that came close because, and they've obviously spent. So anyway, that will certainly be part of it. But other than that, I mean, you know, like we've seen these teams also played in 2020, they played in 2017, and the Yankees won both of those series as well. But, you know, there's, for the most part, it'll be New York versus Cleveland. It'll be that big market versus little market, all the things you would expect.
Better offense. Let me just take a look here. Just give me a second. I'm going to go with the Yankees.
Yeah. So the one thing, like the first thing, Mike Petrella tweeted about this today. You think, Yankees strike out a ton and Guardians never strike out. I mean, obviously, there's certainly some real whiff in this lineup, but, you know, the Yankees still were top 10 in strikeout percentage during the regular season. And yeah, the Guardians were fourth, but they're not far and away the best in the way they have been in the past. And the real difference is not just in the slug, because as I mentioned, it's not as ridiculous because Cleveland now does have some guys that can hit the ball over the fence, but it's in the on base. I mean, Cleveland just doesn't draw walks. They chase a ton. They don't hit the ball particularly hard. And what Cleveland, we say offense, I mean, if you broaden it to just like the position player group, their only hope is to really narrow the gap with base running and with defense, right? That is where Cleveland, you know, excels in general and certainly can excel relative to the Yankees. But obviously, the Yankees are just so they're able to just be on base a lot and then hit the ball over the fence. And that has been a strategy that is sometimes not the most pleasant kind of offense to watch, but it has been fairly effective over the course of the season.
Walk, bomb, walk, walk, double, walk, bomb. It works if you do it. Yeah. Watching Cleveland play offense is fun. Cleveland is a better college baseball program. However, the Yankees have a better lineup. How about that? How do you feel about this outrageous take? Cleveland, better offense. Yankees, better lineup. Don't believe that.
This is good. This is good podcast fodder. Yeah, I don't know. I guess my main point is like, yes, like the ceiling for this Yankees offense is still so much higher. And if you're going to get performances from Stanton, again, we still haven't seen that much from Jazz. Wells was extremely quiet against the Royals. But there's not quite to the Dodgers level, but there's just more guys that if you make a mistake, they're just going to punish you, which is most relevant because of how different that is compared to, respectfully, the Tigers of Detroit, right? This, you could just get away with so much more against an offense of Detroit's caliber than you can against the Yankees. And to me, it's that simple. It's not to discredit how good the Cleveland pitching staff is, which we can get into here in a second, but that's really how I see it as much as specifically comparing New York and Cleveland. It's just a lot smaller margin for error.
If you like Jonathan Holstaff, then boy, you're going to love watching the Gardos try and find some outs. I think we need to name another person. Like we have Johnny Holstaff as a pitcher. The Guardians need another guy.
They're doing
like
it more than
Rick,
once.
Rick Everybody Available Steen or something. All hands on Dekowitz. I don't know.
Listen, let's get into the pitching. All right,
Bob, so, everybody.
So we are going to see Carlos Rodon against Alex Cobb in game one. That is confirmed. Alex Cobb, who has pitched more than Kodai Senga, but not that much more than Kodai Senga, as he was coming back from hip surgery. The Guardians traded for him, and then he made a couple starts, was dealing with blisters and a fingernail thing, and he came back and pitched very briefly against the Tigers, but they trust him. He is a veteran, and he, in theory, can give them some amount of length. He will go against Carlos Rodon, who, of course, we talked about how his game to start went against the Royals, which was very good for two innings and very not good after that. But otherwise, then we have what is really, I'm glad we are getting, which is Gerrit Cole versus Tanner Bibee. And I will say that I do think Tanner Bibee is just being underrated in general, just across all of the discussions of Cleveland. I think he's been awesome for about 2 months now, and I think that he's given them exactly what you could have possibly asked him to do at every turn over the last 6 weeks. And is he better than Gerrit Cole? No, but he has not faced the Yankees this year. He faced them, I think, in his second career start last year, so there's not going to be too much familiarity there. Some of these guys have seen him. I know it'll be in New York, and like I said, this Yankees lineup can beat anybody, but I think Bibee is good. I think Bibee's a really, really good starting pitcher, and I don't think he deserves to be glossed over in this collective unit.
I'm going to gloss over him a little bit here, because the difference between him and what the Yankees have is the lack of length. So Bibee, in his two postseason starts, went 4 4⅔. He threw 64 pitches and 76 pitches. Now, part of that is just because
it's the Guardians' design. I mean, that's the thing. Pull the plug
and send the bullpen out, right?
Yeah.
But obviously, you would always rather have the pitchers who are going to give you more innings, and the Yankees definitely have that with Cole. They probably have that with Schmidt. I don't know what the heck Carlos is going to be tomorrow. You know,
let alone Luis Gil in game four. So yes. I hear what you're saying. I just think the Bibee thing is much more been by design by what he's capable of doing. But either way, yeah, the main, if we're skipping ahead to X factors and just like what is interesting about this. And I wrote a little bit about this for the ALCS preview, which you can read on Yahoo. Like, on paper, the Guardians bullpen is certainly more formidable. The ceiling, the depth, the number of guys that have ERAs under two over the course of the regular season. It was really funny when, you know, they're forced to go to Eli Morgan there in game five, and it's like, oh God, they have to go to Eli Morgan. And then they flash his numbers up there, and he's got a 1.6 in like 40 innings. And it's like, yeah, he's pretty good too. So, you know, they have so many of these guys, you know, that the Yankees should have to rely on their bullpen less, but can the bullpen be as good as it was against Kansas City, which where they didn't allow an earned run? Possibly. But if they get exposed more, how does that work out? Cleveland, of course, they leaned on them so heavily against Detroit, and they barely got by. When they needed the outs, they did have them, even though they did have a few hiccups there with Class A. Even Cade Smith, Gattis had a couple shaky moments. So I think that the gap is a little bit closer than you might assume going into it, but it's just going to be about the proportion of innings that they're relying on the bullpen for both of those teams. Because as great as Holmes and Weaver and even Tim Hill have generally been, you know, over the last couple months, and then Canely, there's still not as many guys where if you do have a blow up start from Heel or Carlos again, you know, you might run into some issues in terms of the Yankees trying to patch it through as well.
I'm a little surprised. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, wow. Cleveland uses their bullpen more. I mean, their bullpen threw 10 more innings in their series than the Yankees bullpen.
They played another game.
But like the Yankees, again, they just like didn't allow an earned run. So let me ask you this question, and then we'll kind of wrap this up. Obviously, we would rather have the Yankees rotation. I think it's closer than you might think, or than not you might think, but then some people might think. I mean, obviously, you'd rather take the Guardians bullpen. Whose pitching would you rather have? If you could just have all of the pitchers from either of these teams.
I think Yankees slightly, because I do agree with you that the length and just like the value of being able to get a 7-inning outing from a starter, which I think Tanner Bibee is capable of. I just like don't even think they're going to let him. Like, it's just, Vogt has said this over and over. I mean, he said this when he takes out Boyd after 2 innings. He said, listen, we've won with our bullpen our whole year. Like, we're not going to change the recipe now, even if we do, you know, trust these starters. So, well, I do think Bibee could do that. The fact that Cole is more likely to actually make that happen, I think Schmidt, Heel, and Carlos are obviously enough wild cards that, you know, maybe it does end up being a little shakier, and maybe that is why you lean Cleveland. And by the way, the other name that I just have to mention, Boyd's been really good, but is Gavin Williams is the one pitcher on Cleveland staff that did not pitch in the previous round. He has obviously been a starter and someone who, former first round pick, who they believed in. It's just so volatile over the course of this regular season. Of course, was dealing with injuries in the first half, but he was just alternating great starts and disastrous starts to the point where they clearly just didn't necessarily trust him. And coming into the season, into that series against Detroit, they said he was going to come out of the bullpen. Could he still be an option to give them multiple innings, either in a start or in a bulk role in relief? He's someone I am really curious about in a longer series if he does, you know, get some run there. But what do you think? Are you still leaning Cleveland on the whole?
Well, so I think the X factor is Carlos, because he looked so good for the, really it was three innings, and then just completely went off the rails. What are we getting from him? Because he's going to probably start two games, right? If he's starting game one, he's also going to start game five. The odds of this going five are very high. And like the Yankees can't afford to just have him bomb out the way he did last time. So I think how he comes out and performs in the first game, the tone that he sets is going to be really important. I think I'm going to take the Yankees, and I think I'll take the Yankees in six.
Yeah. I went Yankees in seven. But I mean, this is going to be good. I think Cleveland has, I mean, Kwan is just, he is really, really something special. And I'm still not sure we've seen the best of Ramirez. That's the last note I'll just put here, is that Ramirez has owned Gerrit Cole. Not quite to Devers' level, but if you look at the guys that Gerrit Cole's faced, you know, 30 plus times in his career, the second best OPS after Rafael Devers is Jose Ramirez. And so he will have the opportunity, you know, to make a statement and to put his impact on this series. But, you know, we mentioned the depth of the bottom of the lineup. That's another thing that we just did not see from Cleveland, especially that middle portion that really both nailers. Noel has just done nothing. Some signs of life from Jimenez and Rocchio in that game five. But otherwise, you know, that's where they become a little bit more pitchable. And we saw, you know, the Yankees take advantage of lineups like that is against Kansas City. So I could definitely see them doing that again. And that's ultimately why I am picking them in seven.
All right.
Let's take a break. And when we return, we will say goodbye to the Padres and the Tigers, and then to you, the lovely listener. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Padres fans, definitely not listening. Tigers fans, some of them are probably listening, because again, it was the best postseason exit you could dream of. And let's start with those Tigers, who were playing with house money. What a freaking run. All-time, unforgettable, gritty to the end. And you went down swinging with your guy on the bump. Again, you were so close. And I feel bad, because I wanted like another home game there. Like, I wanted to feel that. I wanted to see how that crowd was. I wanted to listen to G-Matt Cash even more, right?
Hey, I will continue to be listening to G-Matt. That is not slowing down. I can definitely say that. I mean, listen, this was an incredible run that extended far beyond, you know, just these last couple weeks. And, you know, it's easy to look ahead and be like, all right, this is just the beginning. And as we said about Kansas City, you know, we'll see. There's a lot of work to do, especially, you know, with this offense, where it's just such an unbelievably young team. I mean, half of this roster is rookies. I mean, think about that. I know Cleveland's young. Half of their Diaz roster was rookies. And so when you consider that, like, it's, you know, we can only go up from here. We'll see which of these young hitters are foundational pieces, because ultimately, like, this was, at the end of the day, they just did not have enough consistent offense. And we saw that, because we said that before the series. It's, listen, they had their 24th OPS, best OPS in baseball. Like, it was not a good offense. And so we saw that. That was ultimately how they kind of ended up falling flat. But with Skubal, you obviously have just a face of the franchise on the pitching staff, and what that collective pitching staff really proved. And I have to just say, too, being around this team for really the first time all year, Hinch is outstanding. I mean, there's really no other way to say it. I just think how he views the game and how he talks about the game and talks about his players And what I think is so cool about what he was able to do with his team and what he's going to continue is just like, it's a very different exercise than what he had in Houston, right? Where he just had all-star after all-star after best player in the world and all these incredible pitchers that are just, this is, he has to really figure out how to press the right buttons, and he made it pretty far doing it. And I just think he's really something, and I really enjoyed his insight over the course of the week. And I'm excited to see what that next step is, especially as they definitely do look like a team that could really try and be aggressive in adding this winter, whatever that looks like.
And how the Tigers choose to add will be very fascinating, because it will tell us which of the young players they believe more in. Yeah. Right.
So if they go out, because
right. Okay. So like, I don't think they're going to do this, but if they go out and sign Christian Walker, that mm-hmm. tells me they don't believe in Spencer Torkelson. If they go out and they get Alex Bregman, it means that they probably think they're going to move Matt Vierling to the outfield. And like, it tells you how they tier their own players by how they go about an ad. Now, if I were them, maybe this is weird, they should go get Corbin Burns. They should be in at the top of this market. They are at $104 million. They have two players making over $3 million next year. Okay? That is Maeda and Baez.
Okay? Yes. Well, Arb. Both Scooble, of whom? Scooble's making more than that in Arb, but yes.
Scooble will make more than that in Arb now. Yes. He was under, you're right. He was at 2.6 this year. Yeah. So they'll have three guys, two of whom suck. All right? Right. And so how they choose to go about like, slowly telling Javi Baez that like he just isn't around anymore. Do they eat that money? One of the most interesting off seasons of any team 100% in baseball.
And I'm so glad you said just about that position player group, because they had so many platoons and so many of these just patchwork situations, which was again, it takes you only so far. And the fact that they made it to game 5 of the DS is so impressive, and why I'm saying all these nice words about Hinch. But at some point, again, you just like, here's the thing. Look, respectfully, it's just, I watch the series and then I go turn on and I watch the Dodgers or I watch Yankees. I'm just like, these are like completely different sports. Like, they're just using the different calibers of players and hitters that scare you. And that just didn't exist for this Tigers team. And that's what made them even more impressive, and also why you realized how far they still have to go. So I mean that respectfully. I was so impressed. I had a great time in Detroit. I wish them the best. But I think even Tigers fans will recognize that this is not necessarily, you know, what it looks like to have a championship roster, as amazing as it was.
The way that you feel, Tigers fans, when Kerry Carpenter walks to the plate and you know there's fear in the hearts of the opponent, Dodgers have like five of those guys. Okay. Like,
right. So Carpenter, right? And he, whatever. Anyway, all right. That's the Tigers. Let's switch to the Padres, because that is a different conversation, right? Because the Padres.
Yikes!
You did have a team where I said coming into the postseason, like, this is about as good of a roster as you could kind of hope to have.
Too many people were on them. Too many people were on the Padres. That's what went wrong here. They were everyone's hot pick, and that's what sunk them.
That is what it feels like. That is really what it
but
feels
again,
like.
But again, like, predicting the playoffs is so impossible.
No, it's so stupid. It's by the way, this is the other thing. What were we all saying at the beginning of this? Oh, this is as open as it's ever been. And we might be heading towards Dodgers-Yankees. Finally.
I mean, we have
after all these years, after basically 10 years of wondering,
here's who's in. Ready?
Are we going to get Dodgers-Yankees?
Hold up.
This is as bad as it looked, and this was in a year where we thought it's wide open.
Here are the teams in the Final Four, as we call it here in baseball. The 2-1 seeds, the 1-2 seed, and the team with the best record since June 1st. Okay.
And the highest payroll.
And the highest payroll. So, like, sometimes I'm just happy that we don't have to complain about rest versus rust anymore.
No,
anyway,
for
Padres.
Sure. Sorry, Phillies. Let's go. Anyway, Padres. This is the end of the Padres. Yeah. Again, all the things that we just said about the Tigers, where it's like, wow, you made it this far. Amazing. How did you do it? Padres, I mean, it's just, listen, anyone is capable of suddenly disappearing on offense over the course of a couple games, especially against good pitching. I thought that the Dodgers, or that the Padres lineup had enough people kind of, again, that they couldn't all possibly go cold at the same time. I think what it kind of, the people I'm thinking, listen, Tatis, amazing, right? And he'll be an MVP candidate for the next 10 years, and I feel great about that. But I think the question now, as we spin this forward, as painful as it was, you know, to lose to the Dodgers in this fashion, and how good you were feeling, you know, after that Tatis home run.
Can I pause it here?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Was this Padres season a success? That's how you know it's a good question.
I don't know. I think yes. I think if you asked this, if you told me this in March, I think yes. But if you told me this for most of the rest of the season, I would say no. And I think that that's a fair way to analyze it, because they changed my mind. They convinced me that they added better players, you know, like yeah. they got better. And so because of that, the expectations were raised. And because of how well they were playing, the expectations were raised. And I think by the end of the day, I think you kind of have to say no.
Here's why I think it's a success. Mm-hmm. This place was a mess last year. They went from underperforming,
yes,
being less than the sum of their parts.
Yeah.
This year, the Padres were the sum of their parts. They were not the Tigers or the Guardians, who were more than the sum of their parts necessarily, but at least they were at zero. And compared to where they were with a toxic culture that did not work and a team that disappointed so thoroughly, for the Padres to go out and have just like a kind of a normal season of being pretty good, I think that is a good thing for a franchise that has seen a lot of tumult over the last 4 years. Again, no one is happy with how this ended. Yep. I do think as a whole, it is a step in a positive, meaningful direction. As far as their offseason is concerned, we'll get to that later. The big one is Jerks and Profar, what they choose to backfill him with. If they decide to bring him back, feels like they would. Tanner Scott gone. And then of Jordan, the home run stroker.
Oh my God. Gosh, Yoka finally reaching free agency? Oh my God, that's wild. I didn't even think about that.
He's going to be 35.
Coveted. He might be right back there, man. I mean, they're going to let him go. Why? It's, I guess, Ethan Salas.
With all the home runs, he's a stroken. Anyway.
Wait, hold on. I have one more done. Padres. Okay. This is my last Padres thought. Not about the offseason. This offense is fascinating to me, because Tatis, I have no worries about. He will win an MVP at some point. He is amazing. I'm not concerned about him. But like, if Profar is gone, Merrill, amazing, presumably upward trajectory. But as far as upward trajectory, like, is Manny Machado one of the 20 best players in the league anymore, or is he one of the 40 best players in the league? What is Xander Bogaerts? This dude, they gave him $280 million, and he wasn't that bad this season, but it's like, what is he? Cronenworth, step back, you know, arise. Okay, you can keep winning batting titles. That's awesome. It's just the state of this lineup is in a very interesting place, because you look at it for 5 seconds and you're like, hell yeah. And then you're like, hold on a second. Is this actually as good as it looks? And that would be my bit of anxiety about the Padres moving forward. But Tatis and Merrill, you are in a great place. Those are, you know, superstars for years to come.
All right. Goodbye.
Thank you all for listening. We will be back likely on Tuesday, but we'll see. At this time of year, we are very much taking it one day at a time, like those baseball players all say. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for producing this late into Sunday evening. Enjoy game one for Guardians Yankees. Game two, Dodgers Mets. You can email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast, and we'll talk to you later this week. Bye-bye.